We were trying something new this morning since we were snowed in here in Mount Vernon. We're broadcasting from Mount Vernon and hope that all of you can hear us well and are getting good transmission and reception. Praying to the Guru lineage, Om Jesus, Om Babaji, Om Lahari Mahasya, Om Swami Sri Yukteswarji, Om Master, Om Mother, saints and sages of all religions, we bow at thy feet, surrender ourselves to thee. We who are seekers of that perfect knowledge which thou hast beheld, we ask for your blessings, that we too may be lifted up into the divine consciousness even as thou were, and as thou ever are. Please bless us in our journey. Guide us when we err. Guide us always. And make us one with thee in the eternal, unified, unlimited consciousness of the divine. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace. Peace, peace, bliss, amen. Reading this morning from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. This is chapter 15, verse 13. And here Krishna is describing the exact technique for meditation, and how to lift the consciousness into the divine. Krishna speaking, firmly beholding the spine, neck, and head, erect and motionless, let the yogi focus his eyes at the starting place of the nose, the spot between the eyebrows. Let him not gaze around in various directions. Master's commentary. A majority of Gita translators and commentators have misinterpreted the word naskagram to mean tip of the nose. The word literally means origin of the nose. The origin is the starting place of the nose in the spot between the two eyebrows, the seat of spiritual vision. In stanza 13, the yogi is rightly directed to concentrate on this vital spot, not the tip of the nose. My Guru, Sri Yukteswar, noticing how frequently naskagram was misunderstood, once said drolly, "The path of the yogi is singular enough as it is. Why counsel him that he must also make himself cross-eyed?" The Sanskrit word used in this verse in reference to an erect spine is kaya, literally the body, or the trunk of a tree. In chapter 15, verse 1, the body is described as the tree of life, with roots above and branches below. The spine is its trunk, physical nervous system, and the channels of astral life force, its branches, the brain and cosmic consciousness with the cerebral centers of the medulla, spiritual eye, and thousand-petal lotus are its roots, its source of life and vitality. Meditation involves the withdrawal through the spine of the life current from the sensory nerve branches and the concentration of that accumulation of life force within the spherical spiritual eye. A straight spine and erectness of the neck and head are important and effective meditation. If one adopts an improper posture, his body bent, or his chin tilted up or down, his crooked vertebrae pinch the spinal nerves. This pressure obstructs the reversed flow of mind and life force from the sensory channels to the brain. There is then no reinforcement of the power of the inner telescopic eye to perceive omnipresence. And so when you sit, whether you're seated on the floor in half lotus or cross-legged posture, or whether you are in a cushioned chair with pillows, plant your haunches. And then from there, feel your sternum lifting. Now this takes the pressure off the internal organs and allows the internal organs to function freely. Bring your shoulders back, and instead of as oftentimes as pictured, the hands at the knees held there, hold them back towards where the joints and the joint of the hips are, and place your hands in an upward position with the palms up. And you'll notice that this opens up the lungs so that the lungs are operating freely. Now your internal organs are allowed to function freely. Your lungs are allowed to function freely. Next comes the neck. You make a small curvature down towards the base in the lumbar region and just behind the belly button, and you curve that outwards towards the belly button, forwards, just slightly. And then at the neck, you lift it up as if a string is pulling you from the top of the head. And then just rock your head back slightly, just a very gentle movement, and lock it into position so that from the base of the spine all the way to your neck and your head are all locked into an easy position. Now, if you're not used to this, at first it feels unnatural. But this is the proper position, and it will grow easier with time as you practice. Now your nervous system is all allowed to flow freely, your breathing is free, and your internal organs are all free. This is the proper position. Whether you have your legs crossed or whether they are hanging over a chair makes no difference, but if they're hanging over a chair, make sure that they're supported if they don't reach the ground, so that there's no pressure pulling down on the legs. What is essential here is that the spine and the neck and the head are all in proper alignment. And this in the subtle astral body also allows for free flow of prana throughout your body system. And it would be very well for us to practice this whether we are sitting or standing or walking. And so you start at the very base of the spine, and you put a bit of pressure there, and you increase that pressure through the belly button area. Lift at the sternum, lift at the top of the head. Now you are in proper position. Now we are going to go within. Meditation involves the withdrawal through the spine of the life current from the sensory nerve branches, and the concentration of that accumulation of life force within the spherical spiritual eye. A straight spine and erectness of the neck and head are important in effective meditation. If one adopts an improper posture, his body bent or his chin tilted up or down, his crooked vertebrae pinch the spinal nerves, the pressure obstructs the reverse flow. And so that's again reinforcing how we are sitting. One should sit in a comfortable posture with the spine erect. The lumbar region of the spine opposite the navel should be gently crooked forward, the chest up and shoulders back, with places at the inner edges of the shoulders blades close together. Each hand, palm turned upward, should be put on the corresponding thigh at the juncture of the thigh and the abdomen to prevent the body from bending forward. The chin should be parallel to the floor. While maintaining this correct posture, undue tension to the muscles should be relaxed. So as you put yourself in this position, you're straining a bit to do it at first, but then go along the back in particular and reduce the tension all along the back. Now you can slightly flex the stomach muscles and lifting at the sternum, and that's all right, but all along the back, relax yourself and open yourself to the flow of life energy coming in from behind you. When the yogi holds the spine in form of a bow from the above mentioned posture, he is ready successfully to engage his reversed mind and life force in a battle with the outwardly pulling senses. Without any strictures or pinching of the spinal nerves, the mind and the life force are easily directed upward by the yogi. As one switch pours forth two channels, one electric current into the two headlights of an automobile, so the one medullary astral eye of light supplies the two human eyes with two lights, or fork light. This gives the delusive, dual, and dimensional perception of matter. This focused outwardly, the eyes are ordinarily constantly oscillating. The ego directs the two optic searchlights in various angles according to its psychological inclinations. Under the influence of specific stimuli and emotions, the eyes assume different positions and angles. Anger, jealousy, hate, love, determination all change the angle of vision and the appearance of the eyelids and eyeballs. The thoughts roused by the stimuli keep rotating the searchlight eyes, playing them in various directions to perform a variety of mental and physical activities. It's very interesting because it wasn't until years later, after Master wrote this, that the science of neurolinguistic programming and other associated sciences that related the position of the eyes with different mental functions. And here Master was predating that by quite some time. In this sense-conscious state, the eyes are rarely still and concentrated. Yet even in the most restless man, when his thoughts are singularly concentrated, his eyes will become still and begin to have one angle of vision. In the concentrated state of superconsciousness, that angle of vision is at the point between the eyebrows, the natural seat of will and concentration, and of divine perception in the body. The aspirant who wants to produce the superconscious state, characterized by conscious relaxation of life force from the nerves, must learn to fix his eyes and their gaze at this center. When the gaze of the two eyes is concentrated at the point between the eyebrows, the dual currents flowing from the medulla into the two eyes reunite, and the yogi sees at the center of the spiritual eye of three colors, a reflection of the actual luminous eye in the medulla oblongata. The illumination of the spiritual eye by the reversal of life force in the two eyes exerts a strong pull on the life force throughout the body. The senses, which were projected outside cognized matter, are recalled within to concentrate on the source from which all powers of senses and mind flow. And so we get here a detailed description. Yesterday, we had a wonderful day of silence and meditation. And afterwards, a question was asked about the wandering mind and the ability to be able to meditate. The truth is, for most of us, meditation is not real meditation. It's a practice of meditation. It's practicing to bring the full attention and the eyes there at the third eye point. As is well known, during sleep, we go into dream states. And when we are very active in dreaming, we have rapid eye movement, where the eyes are moving, flicking back and forth, as it's accessing different parts of the brain. And in this way, it's processing all the different activities and emotions that have happened throughout the day, and sometimes reaching far back into distant history, even previous lifetimes. And the symbolic mind, the unconscious, acts that out through various dreams that we have. When we go to meditate, oftentimes we replicate, going back and withdrawing the life force from the nerves, even as we do in sleep. And we are consciously daydreaming. All the different unprocessed materials of the subconscious mind begin to flow up into the conscious mind as we attempt to quiet or still the mind. And so we're preoccupied with things that have happened earlier in the day or the previous day, or as we think about things that are going to happen in the future. And back and forth the mind goes. It's filling the mind, the conscious mind, with all of this content. And sometimes our meditations are just that. It's a conscious waking dream that we are having while we are trying to meditate. If we were to be able to see the eyes during this time, we would know that the eyes are not being steady. They're not being focused upon the ajna. They're accessing different parts of the brain and therefore are darting back and forth along with the daydreams that we have. And so learning to control the mind, learning to bring the mind into a standstill, is something that is absolutely vital. Now, we are given various methods for doing this. Hong Sa is a tremendous method because we put our mind upon that which is higher. We put our mind upon the ajna, first of all. And then with the mind, we are repeating Hong Sa. Now, Hong Sa are two Sanskrit words that refer to the great I Am. So with each breath, we are affirming the true self, the higher self, the I Am. As in the Old Testament, I am that I am. It is the great self, the universal self. We have to give the mind something to focus upon. And so we give it that. And because these Sanskrit syllables are tuned to the ajna, each one of the so-called petals of the chakras. Now, these are pictured as petals. They look like flowers. But really, they're radiance of light and of vibration. And that they're in the Sanskrit language, which is a sacred language, every one of those petals have a correspondence of a vibration in a letter or a sound of the Sanskrit language. And the Hong Sa, if you listen very carefully when it's very still, you'll notice that the incoming breath and the outgoing breath make different noises. One is higher and one is lower. One is Hong and the other is Sa. And so with each one, we are resonating with the two petals of the sixth chakra. And so we learn to focus there. Now, what happens as you focus there is that at first you may feel a tingling sensation. This tingle sensation, whether you feel it in the ajna or other places in the body, is pure life force. It's prana. And it's a signal that the prana is being directed towards the third eye point. And then you may feel a pressure. Now, this pressure is magnetism. And it's stronger. And so if you just continue with the Hong Sa, and you continue to focus on that third eye point, that magnetism will begin to draw you into the third eye point. Now, the tingling is the gold light. The magnetism is of the blue light. And so whether you see those lights or whether you feel them, it doesn't make any difference. Both will draw you in to that spiritual eye. And as you become completely focused there, you will notice that a great pressure may build there, and that is the magnetism that is building. It's nothing to be concerned about. It can actually get painful at times. But don't strain. just simply continue with the breath and the Hong Sa method. Now, when I was taught about hammer and saws and doing different skills, a hand saw, I was told, you put a little pressure on it, but then you let the saw do the work. Now, you must put a little pressure or the teeth of the saw won't bite into the wood, and you won't make any progress. It'll just stay on the surface. But if you press too hard, it binds the saw up, and you retard your progress. So you learn to put the right amount of pressure and to get a rhythm going. And then you get a skill and an art of how to saw that wood. The meditation is a similar kind of thing. You're cutting through the wood of ignorance. And you want to apply the pressure of intention, of will, and to allow that to cut through the wood of ignorance. But you don't want to press too hard. You don't want to try to focus so hard that you're actually getting in the way and you're binding up the process because you're pushing too hard with it. So there's an art of balance in finding the right amount of will to put into it. But if you do that, you'll be completely present to the Hong Sa method without trying too hard to push it. And when you get that right balance, you'll get the best effectiveness from the technique. So you focus there with the Hong Sa, with your attention, you're fully present to it. When you do it correctly, you feel that tingling, you feel that pressure of magnetism, and you hold yourself right there, and it can build. And it feels as if the door is closed. That's the pressure. But you just hold with that method, and you keep going. And as you do, eventually you cut through that ignorance, and you come out into an expanded state of consciousness. You feel yourself flowing out into a great field of consciousness. Actually, you cannot touch any limits of that consciousness. And if your mind goes back into the past, it feels as if there has never been a time when that self of who you really are has not existed. You feel like you have always existed. And if your mind stretches out into the so-called future, you know that there will never be a time that you will not exist. You have always existed. You always will. And that all, actually, everything that we call time is present right here in this moment. This allows you to pierce through that star, and you enter into this beautiful ocean of white light. And there is no more thought interference. You are at perfect peace, and you are in perfect bliss and stillness. You don't feel that there's any place for you to go. There is nothing for you to do in that state. You are at perfect rest in that bliss. And it is the most beautiful, it is the most wonderful thing that you can possibly do. Continuing on with Master, this Gita stanza, therefore, advises the devotee of the necessity of concentrating the light of the two eyes at the point between the two eyebrows, at the origin of the nose, as a prime requisite of yoga meditation. The single eye of light reflected in the forehead from the medulla is the astral eye of intuitive omnipresent perception. When the light of the two eyes is concentrated between the eyebrows as a single reinforced light, the yogi can see his body as made of the light that emanates from God. The soul uses the spherical astral eye of intuition to perceive cosmic light and cosmic consciousness. Now, this is a wonderful thing. We're seeing more and more with technology, and the kind of technology we're using this morning is an example of that. Here we have, through wireless connection, an ability to hear one another, and we also have the ability to see each other upon a computer screen. And so this era of technological magic is actually a reflection of what great yogis know can happen right within their own beings. In your heart center is a receiver, and there you can receive the vibrations and the translation of anyone's thought over any amount of space or time, even crossing the barriers of what we call death. There is no limit that you can receive there in the heart center. Master described that when his disciple Kashi left the body, he made a demand of Master that when he reincarnated, that Master would bring him back to the path. And so Master was mindful, and he felt that Kashi would reincarnate again, since he had such a passion to get his realization. And so Master devised a method. By concentrating at the heart center, he would hold up his two hands like antenna. And at various times, he would hold up these two hands and he would round himself around and around, like radar, only radar hadn't really been discovered at that time, but that's what he was emulating. It was a radar dish. And so he would go around and around at various times. And one day, as he was doing this, he heard very clearly in his mind, "I am Kashi, and I am born again." And so he followed this much undisguised amusement of those people who were around him, not understanding what he was doing as he was twirling around with his arms up, and then he started going down a particular lane. And they followed him, as being with Master was always great fun, so they didn't know what he was doing. And Master went up to a house, and there he introduced himself, and the lady was pregnant. And so he told them something about this soul that would be born to them. And when he was old enough, he wrote to Master, who was in America at that time, and Master directed him to a great yogi who was a disciple of Babaji's up in the Himalayas, so that he could continue in his spiritual journey. And he went and he continued on there for many, many years, practicing the deeper yogic methods. Now, the reason why yogis remove themselves from society is to get rid of all the distracting stimulations that society has to offer, but also to get rid of all the vibrations. If you could see around you in a city or where there are many people at, you would see that there are many vibrations that are constantly bombarding you. And so yogis, becoming more and more sensitive to this, begin to remove themselves from society. And sometimes it has been thought that someone who has been a householder can practice being a good person, but they can't really achieve realization because they can't remove themselves from all this distracting vibrations that are constantly around them. But we have been given the very finest tools in order to make our mind indrawn. And when we do so, we're able to draw the mind in. Now, it's not an easy task to do. We're filled with stimulation all through the day. And then when we try to close our eyes, we get bombarded with everything that we have absorbed through the day. But if we can master ourselves here, during this time, when we are living in this body, in this world, doing the different functions that we do, then we've really achieved something, because nothing will be able to keep our attention away from God then. We will have conquered it under the most difficult situations. If there is a time and a need for you to remove yourself from society in order to deepen your concentration, then God will arrange for that. That certainly happened in my own case. and God will arrange it for you if that's necessary. But in some cases it is, in other cases it is not. Rajasi, for instance, lived in the world and a very active life. He was very self-disciplined. His wife was not in favor of his spiritual path. And this sometimes happens where a spouse is either not interested or even a bit opposed to it all. And so we have to contend with that too. But Rajasi showed through his own perfect example how even living in an unsupportive environment, so he would go to work and that's where he would meditate at, so that he didn't have those distracting vibrations of a disapproving wife. And so when Master would come to visit him, they would even have to arrange it so his wife wasn't around when Master came to visit, otherwise she would put up a fuss and it wasn't pleasant. So that's how he had to go. Plus he had all the responsibility of several companies that he was running, insurance companies. And so he had all of that going all at the same time. So if he could do that, then we can do it. If Lari Mahasaya could do it, living in a family and carrying on the duties of his life, then we can do it. We have these examples. Mother also, although there were times because of the great work that she was doing, she was eventually taken out of everyday life. But for years, she had her family, she had all the responsibilities, and yet she practiced what she could and did what she could in terms of practicing these methods. And as a result of that, she achieved the very highest of realization. So we should not despair if we do not have what we think are ideal situations. God has placed us in the perfect place, if you would accept it. Get rid of your resentment. Get rid of your excuse making. Get rid of everything that interferes between you and God. Master one time was talking, and he was talking to some individuals who were looking for work. And I was thinking about Master, if he was looking for work in some vocation in the world. And I know that he would turn the world upside down if that's how he felt directed to get that work. He wouldn't just fill out a resume on the internet and then sit back and wait for the world to call him. He'd be out doing things. He'd be out finding the work. He'd be beating the bushes. He'd be using his intuition and creativity. He would engage his entire self in order to gain his objective, even as he did with God. So we should not be into excuse making. We should use the challenges of this life to make us go deeper, to find that inner voice of instruction in order to overcome and come into the highest states of consciousness. Returning back to Master, the ordinary man concentrating his vision with half-closed eyes at the point between the eyebrows feels eye strain in the beginning owing to the unfamiliar practice. The yogi, on the other hand, used to concentrating upward on his spiritual eye, finds it distasteful to identify his consciousness with the downward material vision of his two physical eyes. Concentrating on the point between the two eyebrows during meditation helps the devotee to keep his eyes neither fully closed nor fully opened. The practice prevents the onrush of either subconscious slumber or complete conscious wakefulness. Thus, the meditating yogi learns to penetrate into the superconscious sphere existing between the subconscious darkness above and the visible light below. The dividing line between the upper darkness and the lower material light of the half-closed eyes and half-opened eyes is called the horizon of superconsciousness. A person meditating with closed eyes may fall asleep. Trying to meditate with open eyes, he may be thwarted by the stubborn visions of matter. That is why the yogi is advised to avoid the total darkness of closed eyes and the full light of opened eyes Instead, he concentrates his vision on the superconscious horizon. And again, Master is here speaking of the beginning yogi. And if that's helpful to you, to keep the eyes part open and part closed. But when you become fully absorbed within, it's natural for your eyes to roll completely up. If a person deeply concentrates on this horizon at the point between the eyebrows, where darkness and light meet, without straining the eyes, he refocuses the two currents in the two eyes into the original single current, and gradually learns to penetrate through the spiritual eye into the superconscious beatitude. In this way, the mortal habit of dual frontal vision, or of perceiving dimensional matter, is changed into the spherical vision or intuitive perception of the one omnipresence. This past week, we celebrated the birth of Master. And these are the great truths that he came to bring. He is distilling into beautiful language and simple precepts the greatest mystical truths of the yogis of all time. Now, original Christianity had these truths. Jesus taught them to his disciples, and his disciples handed it down. But in the Dark Ages, these inner truths, by and large, to the general populace were lost. And there are very few examples where they have been maintained down through time. Jesus made a request of Babaji to send an accomplished yogi to the West, one who could communicate to the West these great truths. And he found a great one in Master. For Master was not only an accomplished yogi, but he was a personality of tremendous magnitude. When Lari Mahasya said that he was like a steam locomotive that would carry many souls to God, he was not at all wrong in that description. Master was of delightful personality. He had a tremendous sense of humor. He had tremendous humility. And most of all, he had a tremendous love of God and a desire to serve God. He sacrificed himself in so many ways in order to bring these great truths to the West. He left the comforts of hearth and home, of familiar language and habits. He loved to travel, it is true. But anybody who has lived in a different culture with a different language for some time knows that there is a strain that goes with that, even though after a while you adapt to it and you find it even comfortable. Nevertheless, Master came with very few English skills. He was used to an easy intimacy with brother disciples. And he came here to the West, where oftentimes he was viewed with suspicion. He was viewed with jealousy, sometimes by others in the Indian community. And many times he did not get the support. When one disciple came to Master, Master said, "In India, all the disciples support the guru. But here I have disciples coming, and I'm expected to support everybody else." It was quite a thing. And he started this large organization with many buildings and beautiful sites. And most of all, he gave us these tremendous teachings. These teachings are universal. They're not just Master's, of course, although he imprints them with his own superconscious state. And they bring a power to them. But even if all the books on yoga were destroyed, nevertheless, the principles would eventually be discovered. But fortunately, we don't have to rediscover the wheel. We're given here the way to concentrate our mind. Now, the other day, I was ask about Papa's path, because Mother teaches us both. She teaches us the lessons from Master. She also teaches us the lessons from Papa. And Papa, in his teachings, emphasizes the repetition of God's name. And he doesn't talk so much about the focus upon the Ajna, although a careful reading of Papa will show that the exact same principles that Master speaks of, Papa also elucidates. Reading from Guru's Grace, an autobiography of Mother Krishnabai, translated by Swami Ramdas, Chapter 17, Spiritual Illumination. Papa, the ocean of kindness, you asked me to compose songs like Mirabai and others. To this I did not agree. Then you questioned me. In that case, what do you want to be like? I replied, I do not wish to be like anybody. To this you asked, do you wish to be like Ram Dass? I replied, I don't want to be like you, a guru carrying on the work as you do. I want to be one with your eternal and infinite being, and know you and I are one. Besides, nobody should know that I have realized your immanent and transcendent being. This kind of prayer was often rising in my heart. Oh, all-pervading Papa, in those days, although I was saying that you were all-pervading Papa, this conviction had not taken root in me. I secretly felt that I had reverence and devotion still to your form. You told me that this mental attitude of mine was responsible for the delay in attaining the knowledge of the Self, with a capital S. That is, yourself. Truly, I had intense love for you, just as a child has for its mother. Because of my love for your form, it was difficult for me to realize your immortal being. Hence you advise me, with the object of expanding my narrow vision, to embrace with love the entire universe. In order to free me from attachment to your form, you imposed on me strict restrictions, that I should not speak to you, that I should not see you, and I should not do any service of you. Further, you bade me to stay in Rami's house and not come to the ashram. Moreover, you told me that my mind may go inward and that I should write down all that I did during the course of the day and what thoughts came into my mind. I'm giving here briefly what I noted down at the time. Papa, truth is yourself, untruth is yourself. Papa, eternal is yourself, non-eternal is yourself. Papa, purity is yourself, impurity is yourself. Papa, all-powerful is yourself, weak is yourself. Papa, kind is yourself, unkind of yourself, etc. O Papa, compassion, love, peace, bliss, power, the very being of knowledge. For your child Krishnabai, you are all and all. For her, except for you, there is none. Having manifested yourself as the entire universe, you are at once the player and the witness of the play. Having yourself become everything, and Krishnabai are one. You and Krishnabai are one. O Krishnabai, the Almighty and All-Pervading Papa is dwelling in your heart, and you are verily one. You are formless and also with form. You are invisible and you are also visible. Peace is yourself, confusion is yourself, eternal is yourself, non-eternal is yourself, purity is yourself, impurity is yourself, filling all space. You are the peace and the bliss which are the basis of your cosmic manifestation. You are he is you. Then you told me, all saints got the highest spiritual experience only on practicing meditation. Ram Dass thought that you may, if Ram wills it so, get the experience even without sitting for meditation. But now it seems definite that you should practice meditation. For meditation, sit erect and never move your body, even to the smallest extent, for any reason whatsoever. As you advance, at some stage, you may see some bright light and also get frightened. These should not cause your body to move. You should not fix your mind on Ram Dass form. You should take all thoughts that are coming into your mind as not yourself. You should consider yourself above all thoughts and that you are the all-transcendent witness consciousness. While the Kundalini is ascending, if you move your body even a little, the power will descend immediately and it will take a long time for it to rise again. The ascent of the Kundalini up to the Ajna can be achieved without much difficulty. But for that power to go through the Ajna to the Sahasrara is extremely difficult. The eternal help of the Guru can take you only till the Kundalini reaches the Ajna, that is, near the goal of self-realization. Beyond it, Ram Dass cannot help you as a form outside you. Ram Dass, the absolute truth within you, will then, by his grace, raise the power to Sahasrara and make you one with him. This will give you the experience that you are the entire universe and beyond it. O kindness incarnate Papa, as I did not know how to sit for meditation, you taught me how to do it by yourself, sitting in a particular posture. When I sat for meditation in the night, as instructed by you, you were examining my face with a light to find any changes that were appearing on it. Moreover, I had gained during meditation the previous night, but I was extremely pained to confess that I had not achieved any spiritual experiences described by you. Then you remarked with some agitation, "So many days have passed, yet you have not attained anything. The reason for delay is that you still have attraction for Ram Dass form, and you must have moved your body when sitting in meditation. Because of the delay, I was very much upset. I used to weep and also pray to you within me with a highly perturbed mind, like a demented person, that you should soon make me realize my oneness with you. I thought I should better die than remain any longer without realizing you. Papa, you are indeed permeated with compassion. As usual, when I sat for meditation that night, suddenly I felt at the tip of the toes a sensation as if ants were creeping up. As this gradually spread upward, the already affected lower parts became dead, as it were, and the parts above became lighter. When this sensation reached the heart, I had a frightening shock. O all-pervading Papa, now I mentally debated with you within me in this way. You said that you pervaded me internally and externally, but my state now is really fearful. However, I shall not give up until I fully realize your immutable and immortal being. The fear then disappeared, and a sort of joy welled up in my heart, and I saw a light. Then I practiced saying, as you had taught me, I am neither fear nor joy nor light, I am beyond these. Both these feelings of fear and joy, and also the light then disappeared, and what the power rose above the neck. All my thoughts ceased, and with it my contention with you. O merciful Papa, thus the power ascended from the neck to the Ajna, and from there, by your infinite grace, it rose up with more speed and brilliance than that of a lightning. About the experience I had at that time, nothing could be said except that I had indescribable bliss. How did this happen? How is all this? Even for these thoughts, the mind was not there as it had dissolved in your eternal being. How long I remained in this state on the night I did this, I do not know. But I came out of it, that is, to the awareness of the external world. I felt I am the universe, and also beyond it. Thus we find the same teachings by both Papa and by Master. Papa believed in chanting of the name until the mind became completely still, and then through that stillness, the attention would be drawn to the Ajna, and from that to go beyond to the Sahasrara. Master taught focusing upon the Ajna with the Hung Sa and with the Kriya, until you are absorbed into that and transcended beyond into the Sahasrara. Both methods are compatible, and they can be used by the sadhaka as that one feels inwardly directed. There comes a point when your whole attention is drawn up to the Ajna, and at that point you should focus on one particular method, because that will be the hammer blows that destroy the wall of ignorance that separates you between the infinite divine. This is so simple, so profound, and so meaningful that it cannot be overemphasized that this is the pathway. And wherever you go in this broad world, you will find that the greatest saints and the greatest masters have all traveled the same path. I wish for you that you may have a full focus upon this in this coming year. This is a coming year and a coming decade. And I feel positive. We have come through a very difficult decade in the transition as we count the years into this new millennium. It's been a difficult decade that we have come through, but I feel as if we are coming through something dark, and we are beginning to emerge into something new. And so I encourage you, with everything that is within me, to take time and effort to focus your attention in this way. As with Papa, really getting after Mother Krishna by, come on now. You have been practicing this. Really focus your attention. I want you to focus your attention and really bring yourself to heal. Bring the human ego and the mind to heal. And once having parked the human ego and the mind, to ascend into divine consciousness. Pray as Mother Krishna Bai did, that the inner grace should lift you up, the grace of God and Guru should expand within you, should awaken within you the highest divine consciousness. And if you will do this, you will make spiritual progress. You will bring yourself to the feet of God, and you will transcend any notions of separation. You will become one with that infinite divine, with the infinite bliss, the ever-new bliss of God within and without. And you will realize that is God who is manifested within your being, within all beings, within the entire universe, and yet is beyond all creation. It is the one unifying principle of all creation, and yet it stands above all creation, and all creation is as a footstool upon the feet of the infinite divine. May it be so, may it be so, may it be ever so. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I pray to you to make these words penetrate deeply into the hearts and minds of all hearers, that all devotees, all aspirants, may feel a renewed commitment and desire to find thy infinite grace, that they may come into full and complete realization that will never leave them, that will be their eternal friend, their eternal guide, the eternal source of life, all goodness, everything that is. Om, peace, bliss, amen.